Foundational Books on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wee.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today we're back to the books that made us on Scribble. Rebecca, there was a professor who taught music theory and so on at St. Ambrose when I was a student there. And when he finished one course one year, the students came back the next year, and he started, as I was saying, and he picked up right where he left off.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, Howard Snyder, a great guy, a fine composer. But we started last week talking about books that had influenced us, and you mentioned C.S. Lewis. I forgot to mention a book of his that impressed me a great deal, called The Allegory of Love. It was about the birth of romance, that romance seems to have been off the plate until about the 11th century, and courtly love, which was kind of a naughty thing, but it brought the idea of romance into focus. And he dwells on that, and he talks about the romance of the rose and the fairy queen, whatever it is, and Cowper and some of those poets of that period. Mm-hmm. It lasted until about the 15th or 16th century, this era of romance.
Yeah.
And I thought it was fascinating. I'd never thought about how did this idea of romance come to be. We seem to have drifted away from that in my time, and yet the movies were all full of romance.
Sure, yeah. Well, that's an interesting... What you just said made me think of a poet we had on campus years ago named Lee Young Lee. He lives in Chicago and does not teach, but is fairly prolific. And he, when he was here and the students asked him what his subjects were, he just kind of looked out at the room and said, "Love. There's no other subject. I don't care if you're writing about war or you're writing about," you know, he just said, "It's all about that, you know, wanting it, losing it, trying to understand it, trying to..." It was very interesting because I remember thinking, really? But you can kind of test it out against the poems you read. And I think of him often because I think, yeah, he might be right about that.
You know, that's interesting because it brings me back to my questions about life. You know, I go on and on about this. It frustrates me that we have no idea what life is. All we know about it, for sure, we can describe it, but it seeks to reproduce itself. So the drive for reproduction is so strong in animals, it'll overcome everything else.
Yeah.
Well, now that we're self-aware, we have taken that drive and made something more of it.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks to the period in Europe, a medieval period, the notion of romance came into it. Marriages were, and still are in many places, arranged things.
Sure, yep.
And they are
practical.
They are an arrangement for acquiring abutting property and so on, and sharing fortunes.
Yep.
But romance enters in, but it's such a fragile thing because it blooms and dies.
Yep. Yep. Oh, yeah, I think, we were talking about writers. I mentioned that line in Anne Sexton's poem, "My Mouth Blooms Like a Cut," you know, at the start of this poem, "The Kiss." And I think without having enough experience or awareness back when I first encountered that line, it just seemed true or right or something about it, you know, dug itself in, and I never forgot it. And I mean, it comes back to my mind right now as we're talking about this.
A mouth that blooms like a cut.
Blooms like a cut.
A cut. Yeah, yep. That's tough.
And
it's real.
And it's the first line of the poem titled "The Kiss." And so you go to, you know, I'm going to read this about the kiss, and suddenly you're thinking, "Oh my, this is different than what I expected." But I think it's just true.
Well, there's a saying in Texas: as hot as high school love, and those first bloomings, can be traumatic. Yep. And can lead to some real problems, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Until you learn later on that there are different kinds of love.
Yep.
There's the impetuous kind. There's the sudden attraction. And that's a fire that blames and gutters.
Yeah.
But then the love that goes with a companionship and thinking alike or being complimentary.
Yep.
That's the kind that lasts.
Yep.
And while, you know, you have infatuations, but ideally you have a infatuation that's got something more than infatuation behind it, that this other person is really solid.
Yeah, yep. And that, you know, again, I've got an almost 18-year-old and an almost 13-year-old. And as I watch them sort of approach...
Oh, that's,
you know,
the
relationships,
age, isn't it?
Oh, you just think, oh my goodness, how do you explain any of this? You kind of can't. You have to give them wise advice if you can, but you have to let them figure it out themselves because you can't, you know, it's, well, anyway.
Phyllis McGinley wrote some wonderful poems about her daughters growing up at age 13 and 15 and so on. And I remember one line, "The hearts of the young are as brittle as glass."
Mm-hmm.
And that's very true. But back to the books
back
that
to the
formed
books.
Us.
Okay.
I would like to mention, I would like to hog the mic a little longer. I ran across a book by William Hickling Prescott, The History of the Conquest of Mexico.
Oh.
And it impressed me for a variety of reasons. First of all, it gave me the history of the conquest from the native's point of view, because he was the first, he said to be the first scientific historian. Mm. He had a visual problem. He could not read, and he could not write, could not see well enough to read or write. And yet, he became the authority without leaving Massachusetts, because he had people send him the original documents and so on. And he wrote a history of that conquest that is thrilling.
And when was that published?
Oh, that was back in the mid-19th century, I think.
Okay.
And that was a standard for a long, long time. But what impressed me was, how could he do this without the ability to read himself or to write?
Yeah.
And he was prolific.
Yeah.
He just, to make that kind of impact in spite of a defect, you can say.
Yeah.
Taught me something about don't always look for the easy way.
Right, yep.
And he had that, reading that and learning about him had a great impact on me.
So when did you encounter it?
I can't tell you. The past to me is like melted chocolate. It's all one.
It's all one. But like, were you a little kid or were you in college? Were you in?
No, I think I was just out of college. I can't be sure.
It's funny because I'm thinking, my daughter asked me what I was reading when I was her age, and I, you know, for me, Laura Ingalls Wilder was huge. Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Little House on the Prairie, House in the Big Woods, all of those. I think I was learning, you know, limited, but a bit about history without realizing it. I was all about the characters. But I was thinking about how... Now there's been, how long ago? 10 years ago when they kind of discovered that she may not have written them. It may have been her daughter, Rose, who was the main writer, and I haven't even I haven't been brave enough to read those accounts because I don't want to have it all washed away. You know, it was, but that's really intriguing all on its own because Rose went on to have a very successful writer's life in a way that her mother didn't, and or wasn't living it.
It's I've often thought we present ourselves to others, and it can be a somewhat iconic state. But then if you're honest with yourself, you think, that's not the real me, that's the public me.
Yeah, always.
And I think there's a little bit of that in everybody's life. So it doesn't surprise me that people are not quite what they purport to be or what they're rumored to be in their own being.
Yep. No, I think I've known enough people, Forché, Carolyn Forché, as my teacher and my mentor for poetry, becoming her friend and working with her out of her house and traveling with her and doing all the things I ended up doing was as instructive as anything. Because when I applied to that graduate program, all I wanted to do was sit in the room with this woman who had written this book, you know, The Country Between Us, and hear her talk about poetry. But I imagined she was a freedom fighter, you know. She is. But I walked into that classroom and she had a Chanel scarf on and long red fingernails. And, you know, it was not what I had in mind at all of this literary hero of mine. And, you know, she sort of proved over and over and over again how many people you can be, you know, how many lives you might be living. And it was both terrifying and very useful.
There's an old saying, a hero never has to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you see their public life and that's it.
Yes. Yeah, and the product of getting ready for it, not the drop-in scene at the house.
What was the name of that collection of poetry again?
This is The Country Between Us, and it was her second book, and it came out in early 80s, I think. Is this even, maybe I have the copy with me. 1981, and so I was in college, and I wasn't yet identifying as a writer, but I took a workshop, and this was the book that the teacher had us all read. And it's largely, her subject was El Salvador and the disappeared. And she had gone to El Salvador to translate the poetry of the mother of one of her friends and became involved in the politics because of the people she knew. I didn't know anything about El Salvador when I was reading this book, but they're kind of like that line of Anne Sexton's. There was something in these poems that just felt big and memorable. And I set it aside and I went and had a job as an editor at West Publishing Company in Minneapolis. Interesting job, did it for years, but I had one of those moments where you sort of think, I can't do this my whole life. So if I could be anybody, if I could do anything, what would I choose? And why this book came into my mind, I don't think I'd thought about it much since college. But I went and got it out again and read some of the poems, and I still had that feeling. And so that was what set me off into the whole direction of being a teacher, being a poet, it was Forché, and she was very demanding as a mentor. She the first class I taught was one of hers at the undergraduate level, and she was either sick or she was out of state giving a reading somewhere. She was very famous at that point and just said, you need to go teach my class. And I had never taught anything. I wasn't going to be a teacher, you know. It was, and she just said, you know more about poetry than they do, so get in there and stop whining about it, you know. This was at George Mason University. And I was literally in the bathroom before her class thinking, I can't do this. And went in there. And by the time I walked out of that class an hour and a half later, I thought, I love this. I just love this. So she had a way of doing that. She would just sort of
I don't want to hear it. Go do it. You know, go take care of it. And yeah, this is her earlier work, and it still haunts me. It still follows me around.
When I got out of college, as I said, I wanted to be a science teacher and was prepared for that, but I got into broadcasting, and all of a sudden my life changed, and my influences then became television, Edward R. Murrow in particular.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And then the public affairs programs that used to populate television in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days on Sunday, you didn't have football. You had all these programs on science and the humanities and so on. It was just heaven.
Yeah.
And then it slowly eroded because you could make a buck doing other things.
Yep.
So my reading was on the side. But one of the books that really answered some of the questions that came up in reading Prescott was Julian Jaynes, a psychologist who wrote The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. And his contention was that we have been steadily evolving, and as we evolved, we had two minds. We had the right brain, the left brain, and as we evolved, the left brain kind of shut the right brain down, or at least took it in submission. And he said, you can find this in the Iliad and the Odyssey. Huh. In the Iliad, the gods are everywhere. They're doing things and so on. By the time you get to the Odyssey, you've got a human being who can do and think and deceive.
Huh.
And I got to thinking, you read Greek plays, and they're always afraid of Odysseus.
Yeah.
Because he can say one thing and do another.
Yeah.
And they seemed incapable of doing that.
Hmm.
And I thought, I think Jaynes has hit on something. And he talked about the conquest of Mexico. He said that's an example of a what we might call a complete brain encountering bicameral minds.
Huh.
Because they wrote of the conquistadors coming in and being born from a horse because they just got off the horse.
Oh.
They had no reference.
Sure.
And so were easily thought these were gods or something.
Yeah.
And that, I always wondered, how could he have done that? How could this relative handful of Spaniards have conquered this vast, complex, sophisticated empire? It was sophisticated, but they didn't have the wheel.
Yeah. Yep.
And so Julian Jaynes really shaped a lot of my understanding of what it is to be a human being and placed another benchmark on evolution.
Mm-hmm.
That evolution continues and you can find traces of it. Hominids were on this planet for a million years, but it's only in the last several thousand times, 10,000 at most, that we begin to see something that we see as human behavior in humans.
Hmm.
And so talk about something that changes.
That changes everything about how you think. Yeah. Well, isn't that, I mean, I haven't kept up with whether students are actually reading less now than they used to. It feels like it because we read all the time, you know, and read books and could sustain, you know, interest in it. And everything is moving so fast now, and everything is one of the reasons I can't do social media and do Facebook or any of that is I don't know where to put it. It's too much. It's just too much all the time, and I don't multitask very well. You know, I just so the way that one used to be able to lose yourself in a book and thus, you know, sort of change your whole way of thinking like you're talking about. I don't know if that happens as often for people now. I hope it does.
I think reading a book is the way to learn anything because your mind builds images.
Yeah.
And if you read something, you know it. One of the things I discovered in doing TV documentaries, I realized after a while that even, you know, doing these or watching them, you have the impression that you've really learned something. But if you try to express it in concrete terms or detail, you can't.
Yeah.
Whereas instead of a 30-minute program, if you were to read a single paper, single-spaced, you'd have a more concrete understanding of the same subject. You'd have an emotional feeling that you had learned something.
Right.
And that is why I think in many television things, they repeat things. They repeat so maybe it'll get stuck in your mind.
Stuck in your head. Yeah. No, that's probably right. Again, what you're saying, it makes me think of this one poem from Fourche's book. I'll read. It's very short. It's called The Visitor. But the last line is one of those lines that we've been talking about that follows me. And maybe not, it's grim subject matter. The Visitor. In Spanish, he whispers, there is no time left. It is the sound of scythes arcing in wheat, the ache of some field song in Salvador. The wind along the prison, cautious as Francisco's hands on the inside, touching the walls as he walks. It is his wife's breath slipping into his cell each night while he imagines his hand to be hers. It is a small country. There is nothing one man will not do to another.
That's true.
Yeah, that last line is just over and over and over again. When you watch the news, I keep thinking, yep, there is nothing one man will not do to another.
It's terrible, too, when people, in the name of something good, of religion or liberty or order or something, they find it a permission to do very violent things to other people.
Yeah.
What do you read that is junk?
That's junk?
Yeah. Oh. Well, you know, stuff that you just read for pleasure.
There's so much to try to keep up with, you know, just as a teacher, with my poetry reading, I can't do it. I have stacks of books that, you know, I was just thinking the other day that libraries for many years have been a real love-hate thing for me because I just love that you can go into a library and find anything. I can't stand knowing that there are that many books out there that I will never read, that I will never get to, that I will never, you know, and seeing walls of it is too much for me. I can't stand it.
I live in a place like that.
yeah, exactly. But what do I read for? I was going to bring it with me. There's a really beautiful little collection of poems. Let me see if I do. No, they're not even poems. They're just little one-page vignettes that are kind of in honor of something. It's called 100 Prayers Unconventional. This is not good because I'm going to have to go look for it now and get it into our next session. They're little one-page observations, I guess, that the writer makes of watching certain people that pass his house every day on their run, or thinking about his mother cooking a certain kind of soup. And he writes these little meditations, little prayers. Brian Doyle is the writer's name. I don't know if you've read anything by him. But
no, I haven't.
He is remarkable. He was a writer out in Seattle area, and
I spent a lot of time, not so much now, not for the last few years, but I would read mysteries.
Oh, yeah.
And Peter Robinson is someone that Diane Stokeld, who started our reading service, introduced me to because her inspector Alan Banks worked out of in the Yorkshire area, and her husband was from York. And then I ran into Donna Leon's Guido Brunetti mysteries that were set in Venice and followed that. And then there's a delightful series of a detective called Montalbano by Andrea Camilleri. and that is set in Sicily. Hmm. So in York, in Venice, and in Sicily, I found detectives that were human.
Yeah.
Quite often, they make the private detective, private inspectors, and so on. They give them drinking habits or drug habits, or they're terrible people. But these are real human beings.
Yeah.
Banks, Brunetti, and Montalbano, and I love reading them. I started reading all of Peter Robinson's, but he's come up with 28 books now, and I think I've only read 14.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not motivated, oddly enough, to go back now and finish the series.
Well, so that would speak to a certain point in a reading life where you're sort of taken over by something that you maybe don't feel like going back to later. That's interesting, too.
Yeah, well, it's I think what happened when I discovered Banks, I went back to the first book and read right up to the latest one that had been published. And then there was not another one to go to.
Oh, so you went on to something else.
In the meantime, he keeps putting the books out.
And don't get back to them. Well, that list that we started with, kind of talking about writer, the books that have mattered to us, I would say, for me, it would have been C.S. Lewis, but it would have been The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe series when I was a kid. Then it was Tolkien. It was, as I mentioned, Laura Ingalls Wilder. And then I made this leap to Virginia Woolf and Thomas Hardy, I think Tess of the D'Urbervilles, which I read just because it was on my parents' bookshelf, just blew me away back in high school. I think for me, I sort of encountered what my parents cared about that was on the bookshelves.
And isn't it startling sometimes that the books they assign you to read turn out to be really good?
Oh, wonderful, wonderful stuff.
But Lord of the Rings, there's something we can settle on, because I remember, as I said, The Allegory of Love by C.S. Lewis about these romances. Tolkien took his knowledge of ancient language, and he created this complete world.
Yeah.
And it is a complete world, and the elves and the dwarves and the orcs and so on, they all have their own language, which you can read about, and actually their kids who used to keep their classroom notes in Elvish.
Yeah.
I have never encountered anything so complete.
Mm-hmm.
A complete creation, well-conceived all the way down to the bottom. And yet he talks about when he was writing it, there were points in which he was not sure what had happened, and he had to have long conversations among his characters later on to fill in the blanks.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Because I don't write prose that way, I don't structure things. When I'm always fascinated when you hear that writers talk about their characters taking on their own lives and sort of dictating what's going to happen, and the writer's just madly trying to keep up with it.
Well, I think our theme is going to take us over now. I'm Don Wooten with Rebecca Wieg. We've been idling away here through books that have shaped us through the years, and we hope you think about the books that have done the same to you. We'll be back next week with an interesting interview on Scribble.